I'd like to talk this evening a little bit about the Bodhangas, the group of seven qualities leading to enlightenment that we just recited. In the suttas, the Bodhangas, as one of the groups very frequently taught by the Buddha, as a part of, as one of his expressions of his ways of practice. And most of the suttas dealing with the Bodhangas, of course, collected in the Bodhanga Sanyutta. Now, the basic idea of the Bodhangas, as expressed in the sutta we just chanted, Bodhaya Sangvatanti, that they lead to enlightenment. That's why they're called Bodhangas. So, of course, that's the same for all of it, the groups of teaching which the Buddha taught. They all lead to enlightenment. Of course, that's what all the teachings in the path do. But in some way, the Bodhangas perhaps more, I don't know, perhaps more specialized or something, like the Idipadas, basis for psychic power, seem to have that purpose of also being used for generating psychic powers, or say the five Indriyas, which are acknowledged to have been practiced before the Buddha by his former teachers, practice the Indriyas, whereas the Bodhangas are, as far as I know, not found as a group outside of Buddhism. And so being quite a special and quite an important expression of this way to enlightenment. Sati Sambodhanga, the awakening factor of mindfulness, Dhamma Vichaya, investigation of Dhammas, Virya, energy, Diti, Racha, Pasadhi, tranquility, Samadhi, unification or oneness of mind, and upekkha, equanimity. Now, the word bodhanga, the word bodhi, that we usually translate it as enlightenment, and of course being a 19th century English rendering of the word, but the root for bodhanga doesn't really have anything to do with the meaning of light, but in fact is connected with the idea to wake up, and still found in various Indo-European languages with that kind of meaning. Some words in Polish, Polish word for alarm clock, for example, is related to the word bodhi. I can't remember what it is right now. So bodhi, more accurate translation is awakening. So it's awakening from ignorance, awakening from the darkness and the sleep of ignorance. Of course, the idea of awakening is itself closely connected with the idea of light, and especially in the days before electricity, of course, wasn't it? That usually dawn would be the time when that's the signal to wake up. So they're closely connected ideas. So this idea that the practice that we're doing leads in some way towards our awakening, towards our waking up. Now, the factors, the individual factors that are mentioned here are ones which are familiar from most of the other groups of practice. Of course, each one of these frameworks presenting a similar kind of array of different things to be practiced and so on, but each one arranging it slightly differently and shifting the emphasis in one way or another. One of the fairly striking things about the Bodhangas is that actually, if you look at the factors, sati is... the first one is mindfulness. Sati, of course, in right mindfulness in the Eightfold Path, is immediately before right samadhi. Dhamma vichaya, of course, is being an investigation or a wisdom faculty. Virya, for helping overcome the hindrance of sloth and torpor. And then the rest of the factors, rapture, samadhi, tranquility, samadhi, equanimity, are all very strongly samatha based factors. And so the main emphasis in the Bodhangas is on the tranquility and the kind of emotional development through samatha. And it was even kind of speculated by one scholar who noticed that the word sambodhanga, of course the word bodhanga and sambodhanga are used more or less interchangeably, but the word sambodhanga, actually if you take out the two letters B-O, and put in the letter R, you have samajhanga. And he suggested that maybe the original meaning of it was the factors of samadhi rather than the factors of awakening. Anyway, there's not, it's a bit, bit of a speculative suggestion there, but there's no doubt that the emphasis is very much on the samadhi side of things. But interestingly enough, it's one of the few of the sets, groups of dhammas to start out with mindfulness. Usually in the spiritual faculties, mindfulness is in the middle. In the Eightfold Path, mindfulness comes towards the end and so on. Whereas here it's in the beginning, so sati sambodhanga, and then followed by dhamma vichaya, investigation of dhammas, which is obviously a wisdom quality. And normally the wisdom qualities come at the end also, the five spiritual faculties, wisdom's at the end, and many of the others, the wisdom is also at the end, sila, samadhi, panya, and so on. In the Eightfold Path, of course, the wisdom faculty of factor of right view is also at the beginning. So all of these things can be kind of shifted and reorganized, and so it's worth investigating why in this particular group of dhammas, what it actually means, why these factors are put here at the beginning instead, maybe, as we might expect, say, the wisdom factor to appear at the end as a result of developing samadhi. So that's something worth bearing in mind and worth considering. Now, actual factors, mindfulness, of course, we're all familiar with that. Mindfulness, memory, bearing in mind, and the quality of mind that bears, remembers what it's doing, remembers, puts together the members again. Yes, our body, which is scattered and broken up, is collected and remembered, recollected, put together and held there. The word dharana is a synonym for mindfulness, and dharana literally means to uphold something. So it's upholding the mind, keeping the mind, dharana, to keep it in place. So it's the keeping of the mind in place, and the one of the definitions is the, in I believe, if I can remember correctly, in Asanga's Abhidharma Samuchaya, he says that mindfulness is the continued bearing in mind of the previously experienced object. I have to go back and check that, but I think it's something like that. So that's, I think, a very good, succinct definition. Okay, so when we practice sati, for example, sati anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, means keeping the breath in mind. That's a rendering that was used by Venerable Tanisaro to translate anapanasati, and I think it's a very good one. Keeping the breath in mind. This is what anapanasati means. Keeping it there, keeping it in mind. Yeah, this is one of the most important meanings of sati. But of course, the literal meaning of sati is memory. And originally, the idea was that it was the act of remembering the sacred texts. And this is, of course, the Brahmanical sacred literature. A large part of it is called the smriti, the sati. So sati is the faculty that you used in order to recollect the texts. And so the Brahmins would learn their Vedas. They would sit down. You know, imagine the method that you'd use in those days for memorizing scriptures. You didn't have books and, you know, internet databases and all of these kinds of things. But to learn the scripture, it would probably have been done in much the same way as Indian classical music is still learnt today, where a teacher and a student sits down together and the teacher recites a phrase, the student repeats it, the teacher recites it again, the student repeats it, until the teacher is happy that the student's recited it correctly, and then they move on to the next and the next, and this is how it's learnt. Something like that. There'd of course be different methods, but something like that. And then the student's job would be to continually remember, bear in mind that passage that they'd remembered. And it's actually described how to do that in the Brahmanical literature. And it says that the student would, after in the morning, after waking up and doing the rituals and having breakfast and doing his necessary duties, would go off into the forest, into a quiet, secluded place with nobody around. And they would sit down there carefully and without any distractions, in a quiet, still place, they would bring to mind the holy Vedas and recite those to keep their memory fresh. So that, to me, that's a very suggestive description, because obviously it sounds very much like somebody going off to meditate, doesn't it? It's basically exactly the same as meditation, except instead of watching a meditation object, you're recalling a sacred scripture. But even that is not so different, because even in Buddhism, traditional Buddhist meditations very often involve actually recollecting some kind of sacred scripture. So that if you're doing the Buddhanusati, recollection of the Buddha meditation, then you recollect Ditipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho and bring to mind the meanings of those words, for example. Or you might even strip that back to its barest essence, as they do in the Thai forest tradition, and just recite Buddha-ho, Buddha-ho, Buddha-ho. And that's a kind of recollection, the Buddha taken back to its most elementary form. And so you can see there that actually that's Buddha-ho Bhagavati, as we've just recited. Buddha-ho is part of the ancient scriptures, and so even using that one word, you're actually reciting one of the scriptures. And in similar ways, the different meditations would very often be based on some kind of scriptural recollection, kesa, loma, naka, danta, and so on. So the different ones we recited differently, or the metta, ahang sukhito homi, and so on. So there's a spectrum between remembering a scripture or a sutta and meditation, where certain passages from scriptures are used as an aid, as a mantra in meditation, in order to help you gain concentration. And I think that this is telling us something about what this word sati means, and why the same word is used both for remembering scriptures and also for meditation. So come back to that image. So bring to mind the image of the Brahman with his white cloth and his string around his shoulder and so on, and he's gone off into the forest, and he's sitting there recalling the verses from the Vedas, which he would love so much, yeah? Om Bhur Bhuvaswa Tatsavitur Varenya, and these other verses from the Vedas, which would be so holy for him, so powerful. It would not be, you know, it's not just a matter of a sort of a kind of mechanical recollection. Tatsavitur Varenya, that glorious rising sun, yeah? Dihoyonaha Prachodayat, whose awakening divine rays impel my awakening consciousness. So these would be verses of inspiration, which would be used to elate the mind and inspire the mind and bring the mind up to that sense of light and awakening and joy, which the Vedas themselves are full of, and the Vedic literature, even though it gets a pretty bad rap in the suttas, and Buddha said it's like a, you know, completely useless and all of these kinds of things. But actually, if you read it, what's striking about the Vedas is not so much the wisdom content on it. You know, it's mainly verses of praise and so on. It's not a whole lot of philosophy in most of it. But what's really striking about it, it's actually very emotionally quite uplifting. It's a very positive, very strong, confident voice which is being heard all the way through the Vedas, and so you can imagine that reciting these verses would bring those qualities to mind, the joy, the kind of the inspiration that comes from these very holy verses. And so as they're reciting, the Brahman, you know, your mind gets into a zone, and if you've been memorizing some of the suttas and so on, then you'll find that as you're practicing, your mind does get into a kind of a zone. You're starting to roll along with the recitation. You can just sort of be one with it and sort of go along. And of course, when you get too involved in it, it becomes too conscious, then you begin to, or it becomes too self-conscious, then you forget and stumble. But when you just sort of become one with it and go along with it, it just sort of flows. It all comes out. And so it's interesting that the Buddha said that when the Brahman came to him and said, why do sometimes the mantras appear to clear to me and sometimes they don't? Of course, the mantras in this context meaning the Vedas. And the Buddha said, well, when you have the five hindrances, then the Vedas are not clear And when you don't have the five hindrances, the Vedas are clear. So in other words, that practice and the memorizing the Vedas is very closely associated with abandoning the five hindrances. And of course, abandoning the five hindrances is essential to gaining jhana. And also, abandoning the five hindrances is exactly what the seven Bodhisattvas are supposed to do. Again and again and again in the Bodhisattva Samyutta, the Buddha says that practicing these seven Bodhisattvas will abandon the five hindrances. So we're beginning to see kind of a pattern which is making sense of these things, that this sati, bringing to mind, recollecting the teaching, is so kind of closely connected with the idea of meditation. They're not two separate things, and this is why memorizing, chanting and recalling them has always been a part of the Buddhist tradition. Even after 2,000 years of having texts written down, we still memorize the texts. And so when the Buddha was talking about these Bodhisattvas, he actually described this mindfulness Bodhisattva in terms of recollecting the texts. So there's one passage where the Buddha says that somebody hears the teaching, okay, so they hear what's being taught by the Buddha, they go away and they remember it with their sati. So that's developing their sati sambodhanga. Remembering it with their sati, then they investigate the meaning of it, dhamma vichaya. Investigating the meaning, energy springs up, because you're actually applying your mind, you're putting work into it. And then that gives rise to rapture. The mind has energy, has rapture. Rapture gives rise to tranquility. Tranquility gives rise to samadhi. Samadhi gives rise to equanimity. So there's a causal sequence here, and that causal sequence starts out with hearing the teachings and remembering it. Of course, for us, it's very difficult, probably impossible, to do that. We've lost the skills on both sides, both the skill of the teaching skill that the Buddha had to be able to teach in a way that was so memorable, and also the skill to be able to remember things as they were being taught. So for us, if we want to develop this, yes, of course, it's good to, after a talk, to try to remember what was said, to reflect on it, and so on and so forth. But in terms of really memorizing the teachings, usually we do it by getting the suttas, copies of the suttas and chants and things, and then memorizing them, going over them again and again and again. And so there's this duality of meaning here, that the Bodhisattva can mean that kind of meditative awareness, but also the recollection of the teachings. And similarly with Dhamma Vichaya, that has a dual meaning. And Dhamma here means both the scriptures, scriptural Dhamma, and also Dhamma in terms of the phenomena that we experience, the principles that we can understand working in our mind. And so when we recollect the teachings, we investigate the Dhamma of those teachings. And of course that means that recollection and memorizing of teachings in Buddhism is never supposed to be purely rote learning. It's always supposed to come with that investigation. And it's interesting that empirical studies in modern times have shown that if you they gave a passage to two groups of students, they told one group of students, try to memorize this. The other group of students, they said, try to understand it. And then afterwards they tested their memory, and they found that the group who had tried to understand it actually remembered it better than the ones who tried to memorize it. Okay, so if you get a passage from the suttas, like our chant here, and if you sort of sit in your kuti or walk up and down your meditation path and try to bash each syllable into your head and try to remember it that way, it's going to be much harder to remember it than if you, as you practice it, to try to pay attention to each word and what it means. Get the dictionary, get the translation, look up each word and know what each word means as you're reciting it. And so you have that understanding, and that at the end of the day you'll remember it. And not only will you remember it better, you'll remember it much longer term. You'll know what the sutta means, and it's going to be much more powerful for you. So that recollection, the Dhamma Vichaya, but the Dhamma Vichaya also means the investigation into dhammas. Now dhammas in this sense can mean phenomena, so it can mean what appears in the mind, yeah? So the stuff that's presented in your mind, your feelings, your memories, your perceptions, thoughts, all of these things can be dhammas to be investigated. But on a more profound or more subtle level, dhamma here means principles. And by principles it means the workings of causality, the patterns of things. It's not just the appearance of things, it's not just a random appearance. You know, I have a pleasant feeling. Okay, fair enough. To start with, yes, we're aware we've got a pleasant feeling. Yeah? But dhamma vicaya, what it really means is not just I'm aware I have a pleasant feeling or I don't have a pleasant feeling, but it's investigation. Where does that come from? What's the pattern? So you observe the patterns. When you use your mind in that way, what's the result? When this kind of feeling occurs, how does that affect things? Yeah? When I hear a sound, how does that affect my mind? When the memory of that particular event comes up in me, how does it change my emotional state? So this is that investigation into dhammas. Yeah? And so, in doing this, then, of course, is related to the investigation of the teachings. And so we can use specifically those teaching frameworks which the Buddha gave, which are so very, very useful to help us make sense of our experience. And the most straightforward one of these is the six senses. Yeah? And we can all relate to these ideas of the six senses. We know what they are. With the five, we can use the five khandhas or the four elements. All of those are also good. But five khandhas is a little bit more subtle to understand. We have to study it a bit before we're really clear about what it means. Whereas with the six senses, it's very obvious what each one of them means. We know what the eye is. We don't have to study that or research it. So we can investigate eye consciousness. Eye, what's happening with the eye consciousness, the contact, the sight, and how is that affecting us? How does that change? Yeah? Do we become happy when we see certain things? Do we become sad? Are we attracted to some sights? Are we repelled from others? What's that different kind of, what is it? How does it work? How does it affect us? And so this is the Dhamma Vicaya, which we can apply to the actual appearance of things, but also the interworkings of it, the relationships, the connections, the patterns in experience through Dhamma Vicaya. Now, this Dhamma Vicaya then leads to the arising of energy, virya, and has spoken at some length in various talks about virya, so I won't talk too much about it here. But it's interesting to note that the connection here between investigation of dhamma and virya, as compared to, for example, in the five indriyas, the connection is between faith and virya. Yeah? So that's interesting, isn't it? Normally we think of, or at least from a Western perspective, we think of faith and inquiry as being two different things. Yeah? Sort of faith is what you do if you're a religious person, you believe what you're told, and inquiry is what you do if you're a scientific, rational person. Yeah? Of course, in Buddhism, we never kind of make these things in opposition to each other. So it's interesting to see how these two play, or can play, a very similar role in giving rise to energy. And it's a very practical, common sense relationship which anybody can see. The relationship between faith and energy, well, of course, we can see that, don't we? If we have faith in a teacher, in a teaching, in a practice, we'll want to put energy into that. Yeah? If the Buddha walked into this room right now, you know, I can say to you, faith gives rise to energy. Yeah? But imagine what would happen if the Buddha walked into this room as I'm talking. Yeah? Wouldn't there be an electric feeling here? Yeah? We would be so full of energy. You might be sitting there comfortably dozing off to yet another one of Sujato's boring talks. Yeah? Able to think, oh, good, now we've got the talk on, I can get some rest, yeah, so that's good, I can sort of nod off. But imagine the Buddha walked in right now. My goodness, there'd be this sort of spark of electricity that would go through all of us. We'd all sit there going, oh, God, what do we do? and get up and go and receive him or something, you know. And the Buddha could sit down, and he could say, you know, practice the seven bhojangas, they're good, yeah. And that would be fantastic. Everyone would go sadhu, 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 and you'd go off and you'd practice it so hard, wouldn't you? Sujata tells you to do it, you go, oh yeah, another talk. So this is the difference. It's that faith. It gives rise to so much energy. But Dhamma Vichaya also gives rise to the energy, because when we're investigating, first of all, the investigation itself takes energy. And you know what it's like when you're really curious about something, you know? You really kind of want to investigate. And just before we came out here, we were looking at this question of this Vinaya point of who owns a monastery. And so you're wanting to investigate that. So there's like an energy, a curiosity. That curiosity, okay, I'll get into it. I'll read the books. I'll have the discussions. I'll do what's necessary. So if you have that curiosity in our mind that wants to learn, wants to know, wants to understand, then that gives rise to an energy. But it's also the case that when we investigate the Dhamma, that the Dhamma itself is telling us to have energy. It's telling us that energy is a good quality. It's telling us again and again and again, jayata bhikkhave mapamadatta mavo paccha vipatisarata. Practice jhanas, monks. Don't be negligent. Don't regret it later. Ayam goam hakang onasasanam. This is our dispensation to you. So telling you again and again and again, this is what you should do. This, go off and do it. Practice energy. Viryena dukkhamacheti. It's by means of energy that one crosses over dukkha. So we're told these things again and again and again and again. And so investigating, inquiring the Dhamma gives rise to this energy, makes us want to practice, and gives us the inspiration to sustain our practice. So all of these things work together, the faith and the inquiry. Giving rise to energy. And then we have the energy, then the rapture arises. Now rapture is one of those very fascinating aspects of things that happens in meditation. It's not, as with so many of these things, it's not described in too much detail in the suttas. And the among the Bodhipakya Dhammas, this is the only place where rapture appears explicitly as one of the factors itself, although of course it's regularly mentioned as one of the factors of the first two jhanas. And so it's important that we understand what this rapture is. Joy, delight. You can give it many different kinds of names, but I think rapture is actually quite a good one, because the word rapture is used mostly in a spiritual context in Western religious dialogue. And, you know, they have this idea, the rapture is used in a sense, in a very literal sense, in some of the evangelical churches in America, where they have this thing of the rapture. And the rapture is when actually you get physically lifted up from the earth into heaven at the end of the world, and everybody else goes to hell, right? So this is what they believe, is that there's going to be the rapture. And you can actually get a video game about it, where you go around and see how many good people you can save and how many pagans and Buddhists and things you can send down to hell. And you can actually play that as a video game. So the rapture, you actually fly up off the earth into heaven. And that's actually a fantastic metaphor for what rapture actually feels like, what bhiti feels like. Okay, without all the doctrinal aspects to it, and the end of the world and apocalypse and all of those kinds of things, but just that idea that you're floating up out of yourself and out of the world, and that's very much one of the classical rapture experiences. And so rapture is like a joy that lifts you out of yourself, and rapture is always a slightly exciting thrill. It's a slight kind of an exciting response to the meditation. So I have minor forms of rapture when your hairs stand up on end, or you get kind of goosebumps or a feeling of tingly electricity around you. This is kind of minor rapture. Or you can get much more strong forms of rapture, when your whole body will shake and tremble, or you'll feel like an electric shock, like a lightning bolt going through your body. Or you can roll around on the floor weeping and moaning and crying, or all kinds of fascinating things. You can leap off your meditation seat and so on. Most of these things all happened to me at one time in my meditation practice. And this is one area I've got a lot of experience with. I had a lot of very, very strong rapture when I was developing my meditation practice. And it's quite common, you know, that these things happen. Or people will be in tears running down their face and so on and so forth. So all of these things can happen, or you'll feel like you're going to float up in the air, or you feel like you're very, very heavy. You feel like you're a rock, like a statue, or you feel like you've blown up, like the Michelin man. You're sitting there like you feel like you've become huge and fat and you're sitting there. But it's a good feeling, eh? It's not like you're kind of falling asleep, but feeling like really solid and like a kind of the big fat Buddha just sitting there. So all of these different sensations that mind can have, and they're all kind of, you know, quite fun, but none of them are particularly important. And the real rapture, which is an important one, is called Parinibbana. Parinibbana is the commentarial term. Parina meaning pervasive. And so you can see this in the descriptions by the Buddha of the jhanas and so on. For example, the description of the second jhana, and the Buddha gave a simile, and he said it's like a pool of water in the mountains which is being filled from below by water that wells up, a spring that wells up. And so it's not filled by rain or by a stream coming into the pond, but by water welling up from underneath. And in that simile, the coolness of the water is the sukha, the bliss, and the welling up of the water from underneath is the rapture. You can see that because in the next simile that it gives a simile of a lotus, which is for the third jhana, is sunk into underneath the water, so it's still soaked with the coolness of the water, but the idea of the welling up is not there anymore. And so in the second jhana, that's the rapture, which is then let go of to get into the third jhana. So these similes that are given for the four jhanas, we'll have a look at them in more detail in the Samanyapala Sutta, but they're quite specific, quite precise in how they represent the experience of each jhana. So that kind of welling up and pervading, like the cool water of a spring that wells up underneath a pool and pervades the entire pool. It's a very good idea of this idea of pervasive rapture. So it's got a sort of slight sort of uplift and a slight kind of zing to it, but very, very subtle. You know, the rapture that we want to develop is very subtle. So it's important to develop that. Yeah? So this joy is something that really needs to be developed. It's one of the factors of enlightenment. It's really essential. Never forget that. You know, so much meditation teaching today is all based on equanimity. And if you do like Mahasi technique or Goenka technique and many other different techniques, although they're very good for developing mindfulness and other things, but there's no joy there. And in fact, there tends to be a fear of joy, a fear of pleasure. It's actually an enlightenment factor. Joy is a factor of enlightenment, a factor, one of those things that leads to enlightenment. Never forget that. So it needs to be developed. We develop it through finding joy in our life, finding joy in what we do, and finding joy most especially in our meditation. So you need to find what will bring that joy. Yeah. And for me, that was when I found the metta meditation. I could do that, and there it was. The joy was there. All, you know, very, very strong. In fact, too strong. The problem I had to do was taming it down. My problem was going from the bhiti to pasadhi, taming down the joy, moving to tranquility, as I found difficult. But the joy was there. So for you, you need to find what is it that gives you that joy? Where does it come from? And to develop that until it fulfills that enlightenment factor, or that awakening factor of bhiti, sambodhanga. And so the next faculty is the factor of pasadhi, tranquility. And that rapture matures and grows into that tranquility. So there's the zest, it's sort of slightly exciting. But as it becomes more and more mature, it becomes more and more settled, and the pasadhi comes in. Actually, the word pasadhi, or tranquility, is actually very close in meaning. It's used in a very similar way to the word sukha, or bliss. And so that the word pasadhi actually occurs here, where sukha, or bliss, occurs in, say, the jhana formula, for example. So it's very closely related. And so that pasadhi is like a settledness, a stillness. Now, of course, this is something which is developed in different ways and has different aspects and different degrees. I mean, one aspect of being settled is just being settled, being content, doing what you're doing, you know, being content to be here in the monastery, doing the meditation and all of these kinds of things. That's a settledness. And so there's an ordinary sense of every day just being reasonably content in our mind, not worrying about things too much. But the pasadhi that we experience as a samadhi factor and as an awakening factor is much more profound than that. And it's something which we experience much more directly. It comes into our mind when these factors are starting to come together. It starts to manifest as almost, it's almost like a being set. It's almost like this. It was earlier described to me, one monk described it to me as like a stiffness in the mind. And that was actually quite an interesting and quite a good description. And, you know, I said to him, but didn't the Buddha say that the mind in samadhi is supposed to be mudu, is supposed to be pliable and kamaniya? Yes, that's true, it's mudu and it's kamaniya. But at the same time, it's one of these paradoxes. The pasadhi that comes in, it's very gentle, but it's like jelly setting in the mind. Yeah? It just doesn't want to move. It's set in that one place. There's no kind of desire for it to move anywhere else. And so that strong pasadhi is experienced as this kind of very, very strong settledness in both mind and in body, of course. Kaya pasadhi is also emphasized very strongly in the kaya pasadhi, the tranquility of the energies and tensions in the body, and of course the tranquility of the breath, which can become so subtle that it can even disappear. So the kaya pasadhi and the citta pasadhi, the tranquility of the mind. So this pasadhi then leads on very directly to samadhi. And of course, you know, as we've seen, most of these factors emphasizing that process of leading towards samadhi, leading towards jhana. And of course the word samadhi here, as always, means the four jhanas. And the word samadhi, we've of course encountered that many times, means something like a coalescence, a place where everything comes together as one. So with the maturing of all these other factors, then the mind will tend to go into samadhi. Now, one of the interesting things about samadhi, of course, in some ways we can say that the mind always has at least a little bit of samadhi. And this is how the Abhidhamma actually analyzes it, that there's actually at least a little bit of concentration at all times. But samadhi that's experienced in meditation is something that's quite different. And in a sense, this is one of those factors that appears pretty much as like a stage that's of something, like a result of something that you can't control all that much. You know, like the sati and the dhamma vichaya, well, they're things you can pretty much control, can't you? You can remember the teachings, or you can, you know, apply your mindfulness to the breath or something. You can apply yourself to investigation of dhammas. It's something that you can do fairly readily without too much problem. Virya, energy, is perhaps, you know, it's a bit more dubious, isn't it? You know, we can rouse up energy by various means, and other times it's very difficult to do that. But at least, you know, we can see that there's some energy there. Rapture as an emotional response, pasadhi. You know, we can see that these things are coming in and out of our emotional experience in daily life. But samadhi is something that we normally don't experience really at all in daily life. And most people, including most meditators, will live and die without ever really experiencing samadhi. We can experience, you know, the beginnings of it. We can get an idea of where it's going. But unless we're quite serious and dedicated with our meditation, then we're never going to really experience the real samadhi. For most people, some people can just slip into it by accident or something, but generally speaking, that's the case. So always remember that samadhi is something that results when the mind is ready. It's the coming together of a whole range of factors which we're developing in our mind all the time. And we can control to some degree what those factors are. We can, you know, make ourselves put forth more energy. We can try to give more joy to our life and all of these things. So we can try our best to bring those factors into being. But at the end of the day, we can't just predict it. We can't determine it. We can just do our best. And so it's important to have to understand this and to have the faith and to remember that all we can do is keep on developing and keep on trying. Sooner or later, you know, samadhi will happen or jhanas will happen. There's nothing we can do about it. You can't force it to happen when the mind's not ready, and nor can you force it to not happen when the mind is ready. It'll just happen at its own good time. So we keep on cultivating, keep on preparing the ground, keep on doing what we can, keeping on bringing our mind back to our meditation. And endless patience it requires. Don't underestimate this. Don't think that it's something easy or something that you're going to get mastered in just a short time. Again and again and again, so many thousands of times over so many years, decades, that we keep on developing, keep on growing, little bit by little bit, by little bit, keep on trying. That's all we can do. And if we're not ready for it, it won't happen. There's nothing you can do about it. There's no point in despairing or worrying about it. If your mind's not ready, it won't go into samadhi. Simple as that. Yeah? Nothing you can do. All you can do is keep on practicing, little bit by little bit by little bit. And then eventually, who knows when, the mind will be ready and the mind will go into samadhi. We can't know the time, but we can watch and be awake and be ready for when the time comes. Now when we develop samadhi, that samadhi emerges out of all of the other factors that we've developed, the mindfulness, both remembering the teachings, but also more particularly in applying our mind, remembering the meditation object, the breath, or the other meditation that we're doing. Yeah, investigating that, the energy, the rapture, the tranquility, all coming together, the mind converging, coming into samadhi, the first jhana, the mind applying itself to the object, just keeping the mind on the object, the rapture, the sense of uplift, the bliss, the tranquility and the one-pointedness. Second jhana, the application of the mind fades away and the mind is completely unified and still and confident together with the object. And the third jhana, the rapture fades away and the mind's just filled with bliss and mindfulness. And then in the fourth jhana, of course, even the bliss fades away and there's a purity of equanimity. Upekkha sati parisuddhaṃ. The purity of equanimity of mindfulness, or mindfulness purified by equanimity. It can be translated a number of different ways. So this equanimity is the fourth of the four jhanas and the last of the awakening factors. It's also the fourth of the four Brahma viharas. Yeah? And so whenever equanimity appears, it tends to appear as the final factor. It's a very mature emotional state. Now remember that in Buddhism, equanimity can refer to two quite distinct kinds of things. The first kind of thing is an equanimous feeling, a neutral feeling. Okay? So you can have a neutral feeling, neither pleasure nor pain. Okay? You just experience. And that's very common, isn't it? I mean, you just look at something, you know, you look at the dirt or you look at, you know, anything, a wall. And it's neither particularly attractive or repulsive or anything like that. It's just a sight. It's pretty much neutral. There's not much going on there. So that's an equanimous feeling. And we're experiencing that all the time. That's not a sign of spiritual development or anything. But then there's the upekkha, which is the it's an emotion or an attitude or it's like a disposition of the mind of equanimity. And so this is something that's quite different. So you can have equanimity, an attitude of equanimity towards any of the three kinds of feelings, so pleasant feeling, painful feeling, or neutral feeling, and you can be equanimous, have an equanimous attitude towards those feelings. Yeah? And so, for example, upekkha in that sense is mentioned even in the third jhana, where the mind's still experiencing blissful feeling, but has equanimity towards that feeling. So in the fourth jhana, the mind has both the attitude of equanimity, but also the feeling of equanimity. So it's completely equanimous, completely just there, just watching. So remember that the upekkha, we translate it as equanimity, but that's actually not such a great translation. It actually literally means watching over. Upekkha means watching over, not literally. And so the best example for that is it's the difference between being uninterested and disinterested. So if you're a judge, if you're somebody who's having a court case, you want the judge of the court case to be disinterested, but you don't want him to be uninterested. Okay? So an uninterested judge is one who's bored, doesn't care, isn't paying attention, is falling asleep. Yeah? That's being uninterested. So that's not what equanimity means. Equanimity means disinterested. That means that they're not favouring and opposing. They're not wanting one side or the other to win based on what they find attractive or unattractive. Yeah? But they're just watching, yeah? Equally, disinterestedly, what happens. So that kind of being that disinterested watching is what upekkha is about, just watching. Yeah, just watching, not favouring and opposing, not taking sides, not being attracted to pleasant feeling, not being repulsed from unpleasant feeling, and not falling asleep when you have neutral feeling. And just watching very closely, an evenness of awareness. So this is that quality of upekkha. And so that quality of upekkha is perfected in the fourth jhana, which is implied by the upekkha as a sambojanga here. And so that upekkha is the mindfulness of the fourth jhana. Of course, same quality of equanimity is found through the four formless attainments, and also as taught so often in the suttas, that the fourth jhana is used as the basis for insight development. And so with the mind purified and equanimous, then it's bent and turned and towards the various kinds of higher knowledges. And again, we'll look at those in more detail in the Samanipala Sutta. So the practice of vipassana, the clear-eyed observation of reality as it presents itself to the mind, the investigation into causality, the discernment of impermanent suffering and not self. And this is all primarily based on that equanimity, which gives that sort of clarity and balance to the mind. So when doing vipassana meditation, then pain, pleasure, and neutral feeling should be seen as quite equal, just observed and let go, not to be cultivated. So when developing samadhi, then we cultivate joy and happiness. And you're developing vipassana, you neither cultivate it nor do you repel it. You're certainly not afraid of it. If rapture comes and pleasure comes when you're doing vipassana meditation, fine, it comes. And then it goes, that's fine too. Painful feelings come, that's fine. They go, that's fine. And so it's just watching all of these things. So at the end of that process, having developed the mind to that degree and having that equanimity, then this brings to the fruition those practices which were there right from the start, the mindfulness and the investigation into dhammas. So the more that we remember the teachings, the more that we inquire into them, think about them, reflect on them, study them, question them, interrogate them, the more that we do that, then we're programming our mind to see the world in those ways. We're learning to deconstruct our fixed views about things, our erroneous views about things, and to gradually get rid of all of those more coarse forms of ignorance and delusion, so that when our mind reaches samadhi and when it has that clarity, then it will automatically go towards wisdom. It will automatically inquire. It will automatically see, oh, of course, it's impermanent. It's not self. Of course. It'll be just so obvious. You don't need to sort of try to persuade yourself that. It'll just become, you've already preset the mind, pre-inclined it to investigate that way. And of course, it's from that then the deep insights and the realizations of the noble paths will happen. And so this is why, of course, again, it's leading to awakening. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the seven awakening factors, seven bhojangas. And I offer this for your edification and amusement.